ESPN units already and grab additional physics on.
Great. Thank you very much, Jorge. So first, let me say it's a pleasure to be speaking to this audience. I know there are a lot of old friends of mine out there in the audience that I've been out of touch with for a while, and it's a great pleasure to speak to you today. So the title of my talk is Holography and Unitarity in Gravitational Physics. I should preface this talk by saying that the words, especially the word holography and also perhaps unitarity, are terms that some of you may associate with string theory. So let me start off by saying this talk has nothing to do with string theory whatsoever, at least as I view this talk. So to say what this talk is about, let's go on to slide 2. To me, this talk is about topics that I'm sure are often discussed in this seminar. The main issue has to do with diffeomorphism invariance and the construction of observables in quantum gravity. A primary piece of physics is going to be the fact that once one does construct generic observables in quantum gravity, they tend to be highly non-local, as I'm sure this audience knows. So what I want to do is somehow take those well-known facts and draw some conclusions or think about some implications for the way that information, you might say, propagates in gravitational physics. So it's certainly an old idea that the non-locality of observables in quantum gravity and diffeomorphism invariance and so forth might have a lot to say about the way that information interacts with black holes and so forth. I'm going to try to make what's been hard to do in the past is to find a way to make a clean statement about what the implications actually are. So I'm going to try to do that by choosing a relatively easy context, if you will. I'm going to try to set up a system where I'm not going to try to solve this problem in general, but I'm going to try to choose a context where a clean statement can, in fact, be made. And the way I'm going to do that is to... concentrate on contexts that have a boundary. I'm not going to do cosmology. I'm going to consider something like asymptotically flat space, or the truth is that what works even better for me is asymptotically anti-de Sitter space, or other simple models where there is a boundary of some kind for the space-time. In that case, in that context where there's a boundary, then there's a well-known property of gravity, which is that the Hamiltonian becomes a pure boundary term once you're working on the constraint surface. So that's an interesting, clean statement that will allow me to draw various conclusions. Okay. So, as I say, I'll be able to draw the cleanest statements by choosing appropriate boundary conditions. The best case is really anti-de Sitter type boundary conditions, and I'll focus on that case here. I have a few comments on the asymptotically flat case in this talk, but the truth is I've chosen not to emphasize that in this talk because there are various additional technical complications, so I will refer you to the papers mentioned on the previous slide for the details about the asymptotically flat case. Okay. I should also mention that I know this is a broad audience, and I don't know to what extent people in this audience... Whoops. Someone's coming in? Okay. I don't know to what extent people in this audience are really familiar with anti-de Sitter boundary conditions. So what I'm actually doing in this talk is not the anti-de Sitter case, but kind of a simplified toy model that should be more familiar and that I think we can all get a grasp on fairly quickly. Okay, so with that kind of introduction, let's go on to the next slide, slide 3. So I wanted to start off by sort of summarizing the main argument or the punchline here. This slide contains a summary of the main argument, which I will get back to later. So this is just to give you a flavor for what's to come. The main point is that with appropriate boundary conditions like anti-de Sitter, there is a natural set of observables, in fact, gauge invariant quantities, associated with the boundary values of various fields. So because of the boundary conditions, the boundary values can actually be gauge invariant. The point being that diffeomorphisms that act non-trivially on the boundary of the space are typically not gauge, in the same way that in asymptotically flat space, time translations and asymptotic Lorentz transformations are global symmetries and not gauge transformations. So there is naturally a set of what one might call boundary observables. An example in the anti-de Sitter case would be, say, the electric part of the Weyl tensor appropriately rescaled and pulled back to the boundary. So the idea is to consider that algebra boundary observables, say, associated with a single time t in the boundary. Or you might smear that out a little bit and talk about the algebra of boundary observables in some neighborhood of a constant time hypersurface on the boundary. The point is then, the next step in the argument is to again note that on the constraint surface, the Hamiltonian is a pure boundary term, which means that the Hamiltonian, so I see that something happened when I transformed file formats. That box where it says H is equal to H of T box A boundary observables T, that should have been is an element of. So anytime you see a box, read that as is an element of. So the point is that because H is a pure boundary term, it is in fact a boundary observable. So it's a member of this algebra of boundary observables at a given time t. So if that's the, since that's the case, if this operator is appropriately self-adjoint on some Hilbert space, and if it can be exponentiated, then one naturally has then just as in normal quantum mechanics, one naturally gets a unitary map between the algebras of boundary observables at any two distinct times. In other words, it's in fact possible to show that the algebra of boundary observables at any two distinct times coincides, and they're the same algebra of boundary observables. So this is a striking property, I think, that I would like to call boundary unitarity. Okay, and I would like to interpret this formal statement as saying that, at least at the quantum level, information present on the boundary at any one time t1 remains present on the boundary at any other time t2. Okay, so let me not take questions about this now, because as I say, this was just a prelude, and we will come back to this later. But this is the general gist of the argument, and this is where I would like to go throughout this talk. All right, so let's go on to slide 4. Oh, yes. So I did want to make a comment. So although I'm not going to take questions about my summary that I just gave right now, I did want to address one question that often comes up. And that's a question about the role of quantum mechanics in this argument. Because the main argument that I gave could also be given at the classical level. It's just a statement about exponentiating a Hamiltonian operator, or in the classical level, it would be a statement about following the flow along the Hamiltonian vector field generated by some observable from some finite distance. So there is a natural classical analog of this statement that I'm making, which is to say that the Poisson algebra of boundary observables at any two times are also equal. Okay. So there is a classical analog of this statement as well. And people often ask, well, okay, if there's a classical analog of this statement, how can it possibly be true? That is to say, in the level of classical physics, no one would believe that information present on the boundary at any one time remains present at all other times. So let me make a sort of analogy, and we can sort out that will help explain, I think, what's going on. And so let's look at a simple algebra like the angular momentum algebra. So the formal statement I'm making is about certain operators being included in the algebra generated by other operators. So at the quantum level, Jz is certainly included in the algebra generated by Jx and Jy. And at the classical level, Jz is certainly included in the Poisson algebra generated by Jx and Jy. But of course, at the classical level, we don't usually think of the information in Jz as being well, we usually think of the information in JZ as being separate from the information in JX and JY, and independent of the information in JX and JY. Certainly, if I had a spinning top in a laboratory, and I made some simple measurement of both the X and Y components of angular momentum, I would not expect this to tell us anything about the Z component of the angular momentum. On the other hand, quantum mechanically, there is a sense in which the information in, say, JZ is also present in JX and JY. By that, I mean the following. Suppose I have an ensemble of identically prepared spins. So usually in quantum mechanics, if one wants to talk about recovering a complete set of information, one needs to consider an ensemble of identical systems and perform a large number of measurements. So let's work in that context. So suppose we have an ensemble of identically prepared spins. Then I claim it's possible to measure JZ, if you will, or to find out if all those spins are spin up or spin down in the Z direction by performing measurements of only JX and JY. Basically, what you do is you divide your set of system, you divide your ensemble of spins in half, and for the first half, you measure JX followed by, and then you measure JY afterwards, and for the other half, you measure JY first, and then JX second. Okay? And in this way, if you add a few bells and whistles, you can basically construct the commutator of JX and JY, which is, of course, JZ. So, to me, this is what's going on in the argument that I'm going to give, that, as I say, at the level of classical physics, we usually think about the information content of a certain set of observables as being associated with the algebra generated by those observables using just addition and multiplication and not by taking Poisson brackets, whereas in the quantum case, there's no distinction between the algebra of that you get by multiplying the operators and taking linear combinations. There's only one algebra to talk about in the quantum case, and therefore it's a more interesting algebra. Okay, so maybe I should stop here and see if there are any questions before I go on to the main part of the talk. This was really all just introduction, but I'll stop here and see if I can see if there are questions at this point. All right, so let's go on then to slide 5. All right, so what I'm going to do in the rest of this talk is introduce a toy model for anti-de Sitter space, which is, as I say, I hope more familiar to the audience than anti-de Sitter space itself. And that's a system that I call gravity in a box. It'll be clear what that means in a moment, but it's basically just, let me not say anything about it now, but I want to talk about gravity in a box. Once I've defined this system and described a few of its properties, I would like to argue that it has this property that I've called boundary unitarity. I would also like to argue that it has a property which deserves the name perturbative holography. Thank you. So by that, I mean that at the level of perturbation theory, the full algebra of observables for the system is, in fact, equal to the algebra of boundary observables at a single time. So that sounds like a striking and strong statement, but we'll get there in a little bit. If time permits, I will then say something about the anti-de Sitter case, and I certainly hope to be able to make a few comments about the asymptotically flat case, and then I'll summarize at the end. Okay. So let's go on to slide 6. So what do I mean by gravity in a box? Well, what I mean is a gravitational analog of the familiar problem for a scalar field of working with a finite cylinder in flat spacetime, so a boundary at finite distance. Before I worry too much about defining the gravitational problem, let's take a moment to review just what happens for a scalar, say a linear scalar field satisfying a Klein-Gordon equation. in a finite-sized cylindrical box in flat space. So I have a cylinder in Minkowski space of some fixed radius r. Then we know that for this to be a useful system, we need to impose boundary conditions. So there are two pieces of information that we often use to construct useful boundary conditions. The first piece is play data for the field, which is just to evaluate the boundary on the cylinder. Second is the Neumann, which is just the normal derivative of the scalar evaluate on the boundary. For later reference, it's sort of useful to recall that what these really are, both are the two leading parts of the scalar field when expanded around the boundary. In other words, if you introduce a coordinate z, which is r minus, which is the radial coordinate little r minus the fixed size capital R of the boundary, then the scalar field can be expanded as the Dirichlet data times z to the 0 plus the Neumann data times z plus order of z squared. So we need to fix boundary conditions. And there are actually two reasons why we need to fix boundary conditions. And I have to say, I had control of some general theorems that link these two reasons in a tight. I'll say more about that in a moment, but let me review what the reasons are. So, first of all, we need boundary conditions in order to have a well-posed initial value problem. We would like to be able to specify what the field and its first-time derivative on any space-like surface and have that uniquely determine the field everywhere else inside the cylinder. The second reason that we need to satisfy, we need to impose boundary conditions, is that we want to do physics with this. So we need the system to have a well-defined phase space. The system will have a well-defined phase space if and only if the Klein-Gordon inner product is conserved. That's because the Klein-Gordon product is the symplectic structure for a scalar field. So the system is well-defined physically only if we choose boundary conditions such that the Klein-Gordon flux out of the cylinder vanishes everywhere. So you can do a little calculation. It's clear. Ask if you compute the difference between the Klein-Gordon norm at two times, then, of course, that can be rewritten in terms of the Klein-Gordon flux out of the cylinder over... it can be rewritten in terms of the Klein-Gordon flux through the boundary in the region between the two times of interest. And, of course, because the Klein-Gordon flux is, phi times the normal derivative density symmetrized, you can rewrite that in a trivial way as the Dirichlet data times the Neumann data, appropriately anti-symmetrized. Okay. So, we need to choose some boundary condition to achieve both of these goals, to keep the Klein-Gordon flux from leaking out and to have a well-posed initial value problem. And I should say that, for the particular case of a linear scalar field in a finite size box of this kind, one can check that the boundary conditions that achieve one of these goals, i.e. that, for example, keep the Klein-Gordon flux from leaking out of the cylinder, also achieve the other goal that leads to a well-posed initial value problem. So in this context, it turns out that these two requirements are somehow equivalent in the sense that they lead to the same classes of boundary conditions. So, in a moment, I'm going to pass to other more complicated contexts where the truth is that I don't really know if those two things coincide, in large part because, as far as I can tell, there simply are not theorems about when precisely one finds a well-posed initial value problem. So, it's just not really known when a well-posed initial value problem exists for some of the contexts I'm going to talk about later. I will therefore use the strategy of taking conservation of the Klein-Gordon flux, or more generally the symplectic structure, as a proxy for having a well-posed initial value problem. That is to say, in a scalar case, fixing boundary conditions such as the Klein-Gordon flux vanishes is something that I have control over. I can do it, and it's very concrete, so I'm going to simply focus on that requirement for boundary conditions and basically assume that that leads to a well-posed initial value problem. Okay. So, we need to choose boundary conditions. The most familiar case is probably to choose Dirichlet boundary conditions, so maybe we choose that. So, I just want to emphasize that if we do choose Dirichlet boundary conditions, then, of course, that does not fix the Neumann part of the field. So, the Neumann part of the field remains a dynamical variable in the system. It's something that in some sense lives on the boundary. It's the normal derivative evaluated at the boundary. So we might use the term, we might describe the Neumann data as being what you might call a boundary field. That's just a term which I find useful. There's nothing magic about it. It's certainly still true that the Neumann data is part of the full phi field. It's part of the bulk field. For a scalar field theory, it's of course true that this boundary field, this Neumann data, continually interacts with the bulk parts of the scalar field. Information is continually exchanged between the Neumann data and the rest of phi. There's no claim that the Neumann data somehow dynamically separates from the bulk. But nevertheless, I will find it useful to refer to the Neumann data as a boundary field. Okay. So at the level of the discussion I've given here, we could do exactly the same story for nonlinear fields. And again, in that context, we can easily check that fixing Dirichlet or Neumann or a combination of boundary conditions leads to vanishing Klein-Gordon flux out of the cylinder or conservation of the symplectic structure, and I will assume that that leads to a well-posed initial value problem for the nonlinear scalar field case as well. All right, so let's go on to slide 7. So I want to talk about a gravitational analog of that scalar field system in a box that I just described. Now, if we're talking about gravity, of course, I would like to do the full nonlinear gravity. So I don't want to fix the space-time to be flat inside the cylinder. All I want to do is fix some appropriate boundary condition. So let me begin to think about this. What I might do is work with, well, what I do want to do is consider a manifold with boundary, okay? Boundary with topology of a cylinder. Now, what I'd like to do is fix some reasonable boundary condition on this cylinder some reasonable boundary condition on this cylinder. So it turns out that for the gravitational field, there are analogs of the Dirichlet and Neumann data for a scalar field. It's not very complicated. The Dirichlet data is clearly just the value of the metric on this boundary, the pullback of the metric to the boundary. And the Neumann data is basically the extrinsic curvature of the boundary. It turns out to be useful to sort of trace reverse the extrinsic curvature, as is often the case, and to talk about an object that I've called Pij with the formula given on the slide.
Don?
Yes?
Aren't there constraints you need to worry about?
Aren't there constraints I need to worry about? Are there constraints on this Dirichlet and Neumann data themselves?
Yes.
Yes.
When you give initial data on a
yes,
surface.
Yes, certainly.
You have constraints. It's also true when you give boundary data, you have constraints there.
You are correct. There certainly are constraints that relate the Dirichlet and Neumann data. This is true. It doesn't affect anything I'm going to say, but it's true. Yep. All right. Yeah, I don't think it affects anything I'm going to say.
Let's go on.
Okay, good. So, as I said, there's this object PIJ, which is the trace reverse version. It's the same object you'd have for the canonical momentum if you were working on a time-like surface, but I've called it PIJ just to remind you that. Sorry, it's the same formulas you'd use for the canonical momentum working on a space-like system on a space-like surface, but I've called it PIJ just to remind us that we're working on a time-like surface here. So, and again, there are. You can express the Dirichlet and Neumann data as the leading parts of the metric when expanded in a certain way. If you use Gaussian normal coordinates if you use Gaussian normal coordinates based on the boundary, so take, again, define a coordinate with z which vanishes the boundary, then the Dirichlet and Neumann data are simply the leading parts of the non-trivial metric when expanded in powers of z. Okay. So, again, we need to choose some reasonable boundary conditions, and not really knowing when the initial value problem is well posed in this context, I'm going to use conservation of the symplectic structure, or the existence of a well-defined phase space, as a proxy for that condition. So we can compute the flux out of the cylinder, and it will probably not surprise you to learn that the answer is just basically delta G0 delta P. So it's, again, the product of the Dirichlet and Neumann data. That's just, well, this is true for the same reason that if I was working on a space-like surface, the symplectic product is always delta G delta pi, where pi is the canonical momentum. So for the same reason, it turns out that a similar formula holds for the flux through a time-like boundary. So we'd expect that good boundary conditions are obtained by fixing either the Dirichlet data or the Neumann data and so forth. So let's choose some boundary conditions. The cleanest a nice choice is, again, fix Dirichlet boundary conditions. So I fix the induced metric on this cylindrical boundary. So that means we could insist that our gravitational systems has a boundary which is a time-like cylinder of some fixed radius r. Again, if we do that, we find that the Neumann data is a dynamical variable. It's not completely fixed, although, as Jorge points out, there are constraints that impose certain requirements on it. But it's not completely fixed. And as a result, you can think of it as a dynamical boundary field. Okay, great. Let's go on to slide 8. Now, what I want to argue is that with the boundary conditions I've specified, say Dirichlet boundary conditions for the metric, and also Dirichlet boundary conditions for any scalars that might be present, I'd like to argue that the remaining Neumann data is not just a boundary field, but in fact defines what we would call a boundary observable. So I'd like to claim that I'd like to argue that the Neumann data evaluated at points on the boundary gives us a real gauge-invariant quantity, an observable. So to show that, we should think through carefully which diffeomorphisms are, in fact, symmetries of the system and which diffeomorphisms are gauge symmetries. So let's work through this systematically and start by considering an arbitrary vector field that might possibly generate consider a vector field that could generate a diffeomorphism, and let's imagine expanding that vector field in powers of this Gaussian normal coordinate z. So there could be a leading piece, which is independent of z, the next piece would be proportional to z, and so on and so forth. So one thing that we clearly need for this to be a symmetry is for the diffeomorphism generated by this vector field to leave the cylinder invariant as a manifold, to not move the boundary. This requires that that leading piece, C0A, be tangent to the boundary of the manifold. Okay. So, but we need a bit more, because we fixed the induced metric on the boundary as a boundary condition. And in fact, the boundary condition that I chose in this context was to fix GIJ on the boundary. That is to say, it's been fixed not just it's not just the induced geometry which has been fixed, but it's the induced metric. So to preserve this boundary condition, that leading piece of the vector field, C0, not only must it be tangent to the boundary, so it defines a vector field in the boundary, but that vector field in the boundary has to be a killing field of the boundary metric. Otherwise, it won't preserve the boundary conditions. So the important thing to realize here is that that means that that leading piece of the vector field is only allowed to range over some finite dimensional set of killing fields of the boundary metric. As a result, it defines the analog of an asymptotic symmetry group for the system. It defines global symmetries of the system, which are not gauge symmetries. These symmetries are not local in any way. So the gauge symmetries are going to be generated only by the next terms, the terms that have non-zero powers of z in them. So starting with z to the first power times c1a, and adding additional corrections. So one can then check that, well, it's clear that those gauge symmetries, or those diffeomorphisms that are gauge, act trivially on the boundary. Well, we've just said that. And as a result, they do leave invariant the boundary fields coming from the Neumann data from either the scalar field or the metric. In other words, these boundary fields, phi n and pi j, evaluated at any point on the boundary, are indeed observables of the system, gauge invariant quantities. Okay, maybe I should stop here and see if there are any questions about
it. Well, let me see if I understand what you're doing. Let's go back for the scalar field for a second. So if you give Dirichlet boundary conditions, if you give initial data on a spatial surface, the scalar field is completely determined in the interior.
Correct.
And in particular, the Neumann data is also completely determined. So one could say that Neumann data somehow characterizes some properties of the initial data I'm giving. And in a sense, I could view it as an observable in that way, in the sense that it's measured in some gauge invariant property of my initial data. Is that what you're doing?
Yes.
Okay.
Yep.
Can you go back to slide 8?
Back to slide 8? Okay.
Just a small remark, which I think is implicit in what Don said, I hope. Namely that in order to find out if something is gauge or not, one really wants to take the symplectic structure, which is on this space of solutions, and find its degenerate directions. And then the statement is that the degenerate directions correspond precisely to vector fields, which actually vanish on the boundary. And that is what determines the gauge, which is from Hamiltonian perspectives, just so that there is a complete consistency between the kind of space-time picture and the Hamiltonian picture.
Thank you, Abhay. That's completely correct. Yes, perhaps I should reiterate Jorge's comment, which is that one often, well, especially in this community, my guess is that you often think about trying to construct observables from initial data by working in a Hamiltonian formalism to find a combination of G and pi on one surface or appropriate connection variables, which is gauge invariant, which is an observable. So here we've sort of done this in a more covariant way and pulled a few tricks to just realize that the Neumann data evaluated any place on the cylinder, it could be, well, is an observable, and therefore indeed, if you solve the equations of motion to express this Neumann data in terms of g and pi on a given space-like surface, it would be an observable. In the sense that maybe you're more familiar with. Okay, so if there are no more questions about this, let's go on to slide 9. All right. So now let me try to give an argument for this property that I'd like to call boundary unitarity in this system. We have already seen that there is a natural set of boundary fields which are, in fact, observables for this system. So let's think about the algebra generated by these objects at any one time t. So let me be specific here. What I have in mind is, if we're talking, well, I could carry out two different discussions. I could give an argument in the classical theory where I simply talk about the Neumann data for phi and the Neumann data for the metric at time t, and I consider the Poisson algebra generated by these objects. But of course, what I really want to do is to consider quantum gravity, to suppose that quantum gravity with these boundary conditions actually makes sense, and to consider the algebra of operators generated by phi n and pi j over a slice of the boundary at some constant time t. Okay, so that's what I mean by the algebra of boundary observables at some time t. Just because people are probably hesitant to ask questions here, let me restate that one more time. The point is that what I want to do is fix some cut of the boundary or some slice of the boundary at some time t. The boundary is a... let's just say at some time t. And at that time, you look over the entire slice, and we have phi n and pij at each point on that slice, and we just take the algebra generated by all of those operators. Okay. So I should say that if I'm talking about the quantum theory, I am somehow going to assume that some quantum theory of gravity makes sense in this context. I am trying to give a discussion I don't have to say what that quantum theory is. I'd rather not specify that it's one quantum theory of gravity over another. But obviously, I'll have to make various assumptions along the way about properties that my hypothetical, apparently non-perturbative quantum theory of gravity has. So I'll make certain assumptions along the way. All right. So one of those is that it has a Hamiltonian, and that, again, as in the classical theory, on the constraint surface, the Hamiltonian is a pure boundary term. So that's the statement that the Hamiltonian, thought of as an operator at this chosen time t, is in fact a member of this algebra of boundary observables. So, to be explicit, it turns out that one can do this calculation and calculate the Hamiltonian in the classical theory, and it was done by Brown and York some time ago, and it turns out that the Hamiltonian can be expressed simply as the integral over some constant time surface in the boundary. You could make it a more general space-like cut of the boundary if you like. And so the Hamiltonian is, in fact, equal to the integral over constant time surface of the boundary of Pij times contracted with the vector field d by dt and some normal to that constant time hypersurface on the boundary. So there's an explicit formula for the Hamiltonian in terms of Pij. I should comment, and this is going to be a, well, I should comment that I will be interested in, so far I mentioned, discussion I gave so far suggested that we might fix G0 on the boundary to be the metric of a cylinder in of a cylinder, so to be a static metric. But the truth is that I will be interested in the possibility of fixing G0 to be something that's time-dependent, which has no killing symmetries. In that context, the same formula for H, for the Hamiltonian, well, in that context where there is a time-dependent boundary condition, of course, there is no time translation symmetry for there to be a generator of. But nevertheless, in the same sense as in usual classical physics or quantum mechanics, one can define a time-dependent Hamiltonian, which still generates the time evolution. In that context, it turns out that the time-dependent Hamiltonian, H of t, is still given by the same expression that I've written down here, this integral of Pij times contracted with d by dt in the normal. It's just that the issue in that context, in the time-dependent case, is just that this object is no longer conserved, but if you evaluate on a classical solution, its value will change with time as gravitational radiation or scalar radiation, what have you, flows in and out of the cylinder. Okay. All right, so let's go on to slide 10. Great. So at the top, I've just summarized what I said so far. H of t is a member of the boundary observable algebra at time t, and in fact can be explicitly represented in terms of the Neumann data for the gravitational field Pij. Now, what I want to emphasize, of course, is that the H generates the time evolution of observables. So let me make this point. Some of you may be more familiar with thinking of the Hamiltonian, well, with including the constraint terms in the Hamiltonian. And you may wonder if I can legitimately drop those from H of t. Let me take the following perspective. Let me define H of t by the boundary term that I have written up there on the board. Again, this formula in terms of Pij. Then the point is that suppose I consider some observable gauge invariant quantity O. Then because O commutes with the constraints, it's clear that the time derivative of O is in fact given by the commutator of O with my H as defined in terms of Pij. That is to say, if I added constraint terms to that object, those constraints would commute with O of t and would not change the formula. So this boundary term really does generate time evolution for observables, and therefore, in particular, for boundary observables. Okay. So, step three in the argument is, let's suppose that we can exponentiate this Hamiltonian to define, to define an operator that generates finite time translations. H is the infinitesimal generator. Let's suppose we can exponentiate this to define a finite generator U. Let me add a few comments to what's on the slide here. I really need to make several suppositions or assumptions here to make this argument work. At least in the time-dependent case, I want to assume that H can be exponentiated in some sense. I would like to assume that I can do this in a way that that leads to a well-defined finite operator that one might call U of T1, T2, and hopefully which is unitary. And the truth is I need a third assumption, which I haven't written down on this slide, unfortunately. The third assumption is that the third assumption is that with enough work, I could write this U of T1, T2 in terms of boundary observables at some single time T. Okay. So let me comment on these assumptions. Let me not comment on these assumptions yet. The reason there's an asterisk by the term suppose is that I'm going to comment on these assumptions on the next slide. So let's just remember that there are several assumptions here. We'll come back to them. But assuming that those assumptions, well, under those assumptions, then we can use this unitary operator to relate boundary observables at any two times. And if it's also true that I can write this unitary operator in terms of boundary observables at, say, either time t1 or time t2, then I would conclude that given any operator in the algebra of boundary observables at time t1, I can rewrite it as some combination of operators of boundary observables at time t2. In other words, I would conclude that the algebra of boundary observables at any two times, T1 and T2, are actually equal. Okay. And this is a property that I would like to call boundary unitarity. It has the same flavor as what people often would like to see in terms of unitarity of black hole evaporation,
Don, is there a claim of completeness here?
Of completeness?
Yeah.
Not at this point.
Is the statement this particular subset of observables with their corresponding algebra involves unitarity, or is it, no, this is a complete set of observables, and therefore the complete theory is unitary?
A very good question. At the moment, the claim is simply that this is a subset of the possible observables, and that this subset evolves unitarily, and in fact, this subset is in a sense time independent. Again, the algebra of boundary observables at time t1 is equal to the algebra of boundary observables at time t2. I will say something about completeness in a moment, but we'll get to that. Okay, great. I'm not at this point claiming this is a complete set of observables. So I'm not claiming that all of the information in this theory is available on the boundary. But I do think that this statement can be interpreted as saying that the information which registers on the boundary at any one time t2 can also be extracted from boundary observables at any other time, t2. So that information is sort of conserved on the boundary. All right. Let's go on to the next slide before I take questions, so slide 11. So let me comment more on these assumptions. As I say, I'm talking about some unspecified non. I'm going to have to make some assumptions about it. Again, the main assumption here was that we can exponentiate this time-dependent Hamiltonian to define an operator that gives finite time translations, U, T1, T2. And as I say, there are really several assumptions here. One is that you can exponentiate the operator to define something which is finite, and hopefully unitary in some sense. That's an assumption. Well, I think this audience is familiar with the fact that defining unitary finite time translations in time-dependent backgrounds has many subtleties, but I am encouraged by the recent work of the Madrid Group and so forth that by an appropriate specification of the choice of hypersurfaces and other important structures, that some unitary version of this operator can, in fact, be defined. The other assumption that I need to make is that this operator can, in fact, be written in terms of boundary fields at any one time, that I could write U of t1, t2 in terms of boundary fields just at time t1 or just at time t2. Now, the expression that I have on the board here, this path-ordered exponential, is not manifestly of that kind, and I apologize for that. It clearly involves the boundary fields over all times between t1 and t2. But nevertheless, I do feel it's a good assumption that with enough work, this U of t1, t2 can be written in terms of boundary fields just at time t1, and similarly just at time t2, for the following reason. So it's natural to, let's imagine constructing this path-ordered exponential step by step, in the sense of starting at time t1 and looking at the infinitesimal transformation to go just from time t1 to t1 plus epsilon. Well, clearly, at that level, if we're just going from time t1 to t1 plus epsilon, then indeed it's true that you can write the corresponding path-ordered exponential in terms of boundary fields just at time t1, or maybe with some tiny smearing around time t1. So now, we'd also like to add we'd like to go from time t1 plus epsilon to time t1 plus 2 epsilon. And the point is that you can, at that point, you can use this finite time translation operator you already have to re-express your original operators all at time t1 plus 2 epsilon. I see. I apologize for the fact I don't have a slide about this, because while I'm just talking about it, I think it's probably impossible to follow what I'm trying to say. But suffice it to say that I think this assumption is justified. Let me try this one more time. This assumption is justified with the idea that what you do is you start at time t1, you evolve infinitesimally into the future. And that certainly you can do. You can write the evolution operator in terms of boundary fields at a single time. And then we're going to evolve infinitesimally another step. And in doing so, you can use your next infinitesimal evolution operator to rewrite all the terms in the first infinitesimal evolution operator in terms of boundary fields at later times. Okay. I apologize if that was not something that is easy to follow, but I think it's a good assumption. So I'm making these assumptions that in this non-perturbative theory, this unit's finite time translation exists, and that it can be written in terms of fields at just time t1 or just time t2 with enough work. I should say that one should be able to explore those assumptions, and one should, in fact, well, the assumptions need to be explored more in the context of, say, perturbative gravity. That's a context where one should be able to really look at this. And in that context, I believe that the recent work from the Madrid group will be of great use in showing that these assumptions hold. And perhaps I can even encourage some of the experts out there listening to my talk now to help me look at these properties, or to take the lead and look at them yourself in the context of perturbative gravity. Okay, so that's some comments about the assumptions. Let me make a few more comments about the assumptions. So the comments I made so far would apply to a theory of scalar fields as well as a theory of gravity. There's a little bit more that, well, let me comment about, well, as I said, you could also give this argument at the classical level, and in that context, this assumption really comes down to an assumption about long-time existence of solutions to the equations of motion, and an assumption that this finite time translation is a good symplectomorphism on the phase space. So at that level, this is kind of like a kind of cosmic censorship assumption. In other words, classically, in order for a statement of this kind to be true, I would have to be able to evolve the equations of motion for arbitrary times. Now, quite frankly, I think that this is simply false for the system that I've talked about today. This is a bad property of my toy model, and the reason it's false for this system and therefore, is that I could, in gravity, I could make, for example, a black hole somewhere in the middle of the cylinder, and if the black hole flies out and hits the boundary, then I think that the boundary conditions will be if the black hole flies out and hits the boundary, I think you'll have some breakdown of the system, because there'll just be no solution which is compatible with the boundary conditions of a fixed metric on the boundary once a black hole hits it. So that's a drawback of this model. But for, as I said, I wanted to introduce this gravity in a box as just a toy model for the more interesting anti-de Sitter case. The anti-de Sitter boundary conditions have a lot in common with gravity in a box. I'm sure are familiar with it, the fact that when you conformally compactify anti-de Sitter space, it looks just like the cylinder that I've drawn. And so the truth is that if we talk about asymptotically anti-de Sitter boundary conditions, then although it requires a little bit more technology, all of the statements I've made so far about gravity in a box also apply to the anti-de Sitter case, and in the anti-de Sitter case, it's more plausible that there is this required version of cosmic censorship, that we would expect that the anti-de Sitter boundary conditions are, in fact, more stable. Okay. So, oh, it's already 11 o'clock. Oh, my. I see. Great. So, thank you. So, where was I? Oh, yes. So, I wanted to say that in the quantum context, we would need some quantum analog of cosmic censorship, or perhaps better stated as a quantum singularity resolution. We need this time evolution to be well-defined for long times in quantum gravity. It's basically the assumption that quantum gravity, that if there is a classical violation of cosmic censorship, that quantum gravity somehow resolves those singularities and allows evolution to proceed. So from what I can tell, this is very much consistent with the kind of results that this community has been generating in loop quantum gravity, which I find very encouraging. Good. All right. So we're going to try to finish this up relatively quickly. So let's see what's on slide 12. But perhaps I should let's go back to slide 11. And perhaps I should stop and take questions, after which I will quickly comment on the asymptotically flat case and then end the talk. So let's stop and take questions here for a moment. Oh, okay. All right. Great. So let's move on. Actually, we're advanced to about, I think it's slide 16. Let's skip over the intermediate material. Oh. Actually, let's not do that. Sorry. Let's go back to slide 12. Yeah, there's... Okay. I may not get to the asymptotically flat part, but I think it's important that I address Jorge's questions about completeness, And that goes under this heading that I've called perturbative holography. Okay. So let me... Well, so Jorge was asking whether these boundary observables are complete. Or you could ask, do these boundary observables contain the full information in the bulk fields or not? So is this everything, or is there more information out there in the bulk? So I have a partial answer to that. It's plausible to me that there is more information out there in the bulk, but there's a sense in which there's not nearly as much additional information out there in the bulk as one might naively have thought. Okay. In particular, I'm going to give an argument here which states that if we consider not the non-perturbative theory that I was discussing so far, but if we restrict ourselves to perturbation theory about some classical solution, that in the context of that perturbation theory, it is in fact true that the boundary observables are a complete set of observables. So, there's not a direct similar statement in the non-perturbative theory if there are additional observables associated with solitons or other non-perturbative objects. It's entirely possible. By the level of perturbation theory, I want to claim that the boundary observables are, in fact, complete. Okay, so to get this argument, let's consider perturbation theory around some classical solution. And to give a good argument for this, I need to consider a classical solution which is flat in the past, say before some time t equals zero. I want to emphasize, though, that if we allow time-dependent boundary conditions... Sorry, let me just reiterate. I want to consider perturbation theory around some classical solution which is completely flat, even in the interior. So it's just a piece of flat space in the past. So I want to emphasize, though, that for time-dependent boundary conditions, the classical solution need not remain completely flat. For example, I could imagine wiggling the boundary at some time, say around t equals zero, in such a way that it sends in a large amount of gravitational waves that collapse and form a black hole. So I can consider a classical solution such as the one pictured over here on the right, which is flat in the past and contains a black hole in the future. That's an interesting case to discuss. So I'd like to do perturbation theory. So in doing perturbation theory, we will start with the linearized theory. So let's think about the theory of linearized perturbations on the background that I've just specified. Well, at the linearized level, it turns out that it's actually not hard to... Excuse me. At the linearized level, it turns out that it's actually not hard to write any bulk operator, so HAB or phi, the perturbations of the metric and the scalar field, at any point in the interior, can in fact be written as an appropriate integral over boundary fields. I haven't given you the formula for that, although there is a simple formula in terms of sort of Green's functions. But it shouldn't be surprising at the level of linearized fields, because if I have a... let me say this more cleanly. My claim is that any bulk operator can be written in terms of boundary observables including all possible times. So I'm not claiming that it can be written in terms of boundary observables at one time, but I'm saying if you give me the full set of boundary observables over the entire cylinder, then in the linearized theory, that determines the solution everywhere inside. That shouldn't be a surprise, because in the linearized theory, we've already specified as a boundary condition the Dirichlet data, and now if you also give me the values for the Neumann data, then it should be... I think we all understand that if both the Dirichlet data Well, in the linearized theory, the easiest thing to do is to translate everything to zero. So let me just say this. In the linearized theory, if I require the Dirichlet data to vanish, and I also require the Neumann data to vanish, if I specified both, that's completely overspecifying the system, and it's fairly clear that the only solution is zero, no perturbation. So, indeed, it turns out to be true that this is equivalent to saying that any operator in the bulk is determined by its the Neumann data on the boundary. So, at the linearized level, the boundary observables are therefore complete. And in perturbation theory, when you go from one order to the next, you basically just express the nth order interacting fields are just polynomials in the n minus first order fields. So as a result, it's just it's immediately true at any order in perturbation theory. So perturbatively, the boundary observables are complete. Okay, let's go on to slide 13. So the statement is therefore that the algebra of all perturbative observables is equal to the algebra of boundary observables. And to be definite, let's say the algebra of all boundary observables, including all times t less than zero. So that's a certain completeness statement. And that would be true in scalar field theory as well as gravity. Now, what's different about gravity, of course, is that the Hamiltonian can be thought of as a pure boundary term. Well, in the linearized theory, that's not true. In linearized gravity, the Hamiltonian is a bulk integral. However, at any order beyond the linearized theory, at any interacting order in gravitational perturbation theory, the Hamiltonian can again be written as a boundary term using the constraints. This is just a statement that Gauss's law, alpha at the boundary, gives a useful measure of the energy. So now even though we're in this perturbative context, because the Hamiltonian is again a boundary term, we can rerun the boundary unitarity argument I gave a while ago and take this algebra of perturbative observables over all times t less than zero and rewrite it, we can take any observable, there's a part of the slide that says boundary unitarity argument implies arrow, and the next bit should say the algebra of boundary observables at all t less than zero. Unfortunately, it actually says the algebra of perturbative observables. But that equation should read algebra of boundary observables at all t less than zero is equal to the algebra of boundary observables at a single t. This is, again, just the argument I gave before that I called boundary unitarity. But now putting this together with the completeness of the boundary observables in the perturbative context, we find the very interesting statement that the algebra of all perturbative observables is, in fact, identical with the algebra of boundary observables at any single t. Okay, so this is a striking statement that I think deserves the name perturbative holography. Various people often talk about what's called the idea of holography for gravity, and it's the idea that the bulk might somehow be expressible in terms of operators on a boundary. So this is a concrete statement of that kind, which holds at least in gravitational perturbation theory, that again, the set of all perturbative observables in the bulk can be rewritten in terms of boundary observables at any single time t. Okay, let's go on to slide 6. What's on slide 14? Let's skip slide 14 and slide 15, and let me try to make a few quick comments on the asymptotically flat case. Let me make a few quick comments on the asymptotically flat case. So I'm not going to give you the arguments in the asymptotically flat case for lack of time, but again, I refer you to the papers listed on the introductory slide. But let me tell you what my claims are in the asymptotically flat context. My main claim is that a version of perturbative holography again holds in the asymptotically flat case. For example, let's consider perturbation theory around some collapsing black hole background in, say, pure Einstein-Hilbert gravity. Then I claim that a complete set of perturbative observables is available on Scry Plus in any arbitrarily small neighborhood of I0. So what I mean by that is, I hope illustrated by this picture over on the right, there's a green blob which is supposed to pick off a past, which is supposed to highlight a past infinite segment of I plus, and the point is that the algebra of observables on I plus, and actually including some observables at I0, like the Hamiltonian, that algebra is actually complete, is my claim, and remains complete no matter how small I make that green blob, as long as it still marks a past infinite piece of I plus and contains I0. Again, that seems like a somewhat striking claim that algebra could be complete in the context of perturbation theory or in the black hole background, where you might have thought that information should be lost falling into the black hole. But I claim this feature follows by arguments somewhat similar to what I've given you for gravity in a box, although with certain additional technical complications. Okay. So that's the main, that's the precise claim that I would make in the asymptotically flat case. Now, I think this is very suggestive of a picture for understanding how information is transmitted into, well, it's a very suggestive of an interesting picture for what happens to information in black hole evaporation. Okay, so, well, let's actually not worry about the details of what's left on this slide, but let's go on to slide 17, and I will give you that picture. All right. So on the left, I have a conformal diagram for a collapsing black hole, and I should just make a few comments about what I mean by this conformal diagram. The red line I've drawn, the red horizontal line I've drawn right below where it says strong curvature, that's supposed to represent the boundary of some Planck scale, the rough boundary of some Planck scale curvature regime where I don't know exactly what's going to go on without choosing some specific theory of quantum gravity and investigating the details. So that's just the boundary of the region of space-time I can understand semi-classically. And I make no particular claims about what happens above that red line, and that's why I've marked it with a large question mark. So the blue diagonal line is basically the last null ray, which is below that strong curvature region, so that everything below the blue line. The region below the blue line is the region where we can compute what happens semi-classically and study how that study propagation of signals from that region out to Scry Plus, all staying within a semi-classical a region where semi-classical physics should be valid. Okay, so of course what we expect is, well, we normally think that when the black hole collapses, information present in the matter fields that collapse before the black hole is carried deep inside the black hole, as indicated by this green arrow that I've drawn. All right. So, as I say, below the blue line, the physics is, the space-time is weakly curved, and we'd expect to be able to describe the physics semi-classically or more or less equivalently by using some kind of perturbation theory. We shouldn't need full non-perturbative quantum gravity to describe the physics. So let's suppose that's true. Suppose physics in the region below the blue line is essentially perturbative physics. Well, I've argued, I claim that in perturbative gravity, there is this perturbative holography feature, which says that a complete set of observables is in fact available at Sri plus in any region close to I0. So that means, that suggests to me that the information which we normally think of as being carried deep inside the black hole by the collapsing matter is also in some sense stored out near spatial infinity in the asymptotic gravitational and other fields. And in particular, in the asymptotic gravitational fields, and in particular in the ADM Hamiltonian. So I'm going to remind you that the Hamiltonian it played a key role in all the arguments I've given so far. So we can track what happens to that information. We can ask what the we can look more carefully at the Hamiltonian. And the point I want to emphasize is that the Hamiltonian is, of course, related to the flux of Hawking radiation via Gauss's law. Well, let me say it this way. The useful statement is the equation written at the bottom of the screen on the right, that if I'm in a weakly curved region, then at least at first order in perturbation theory, what Gauss's law really says, or what the gravitational constraints say, is that the difference between the ADM Hamiltonian and some similar Gauss law type boundary term on the horizon that I've called phi sub h for horizon, okay, is the integral over the matter stress tensor, so basically the stress tensor of the Hawking radiation. So the point I'm going to make more on the next slide is that if you buy my claim that the information that fell deep inside the black hole can also be stored in the asymptotic fields, and in particular in the ADM Hamiltonian, then the gravitational constraints may allow that information to be transferred from HADM to the Hawking radiation, which of course would be an interesting result.
John, some people would ask the same question. What is sigma? Is phi h of little h a two-surface integral on the horizon, or is it an integral across the horizon?
So let's go on to slide 18, where I have a better picture, and I can answer some of those questions. So Abhay's first question is, what is sigma? So I've drawn sigma for you in this diagram on the left. So again, the idea is that we want to consider the constraints on some surface sigma, which runs from some two-dimensional cross-section of the horizon, I've indicated by the left green dot, out to space-like infinity. So that's my sigma, some space-like surface running from the horizon out to infinity. So phi h, so the constraints, as I say, will relate the ADM Hamiltonian, which lives out at I0, to a similar boundary term, phi h, given by a two-dimensional integral over a cut of the horizon. And again, at least at first order in perturbation theory, the relationship is just that the difference of HADM and phi h is the integral over sigma of the matter and linearized graviton stress tensors. So, again, if you believe my claim that the information that fell into the black hole is also stored in the asymptotic fields, and in particular in the ADM Hamiltonian, it's clear by this operator equality from the constraints that whatever information is present in the ADM Hamiltonian is also present in the combination of the Gauss law flux on the horizon and the matter stress tensor. One might say that the information in the ADM Hamiltonian is somehow shared between this phi h, this Gauss law flux on the horizon, and the matter stress tensor. So the idea would be, the picture would be, that as the black hole evaporates, this Gauss law flux of the horizon, phi h, goes to zero. Actually, I don't know whether this is strictly true, but Abhay can probably tell me. I expect that this phi h on the horizon has some natural description in terms of dynamical horizons and so forth. Okay. It's just the Gauss law flux from the horizon. So it goes to zero as the black hole evaporates and as the mass of the black hole goes to zero. So certainly once phi h becomes the zero operator, or in other words, if I can use these constraints and make a similar argument in the regime after the black hole has completely evaporated, it's clear that, well, since there's no boundary term left because there's no more horizon, it seems clear that whatever information was out there in the ADM Hamiltonian has been completely transferred to the Hawking radiation. So this is the kind of result that people have been, might have liked to see for a while. There's a lot of interest in understanding whether information that falls into a black hole can be transferred to the Hawking radiation. I should summarize things a bit by saying that questions had always been how you could get information from the interior of the black hole out to the Hawking radiation, which exists sort of only outside. That seemed to require something non-local or acausal or something, some very big change in the way we think about physics. So my story here, just to reiterate, is that the information can be transferred to the Hawking radiation in what is really a very local... The information can be transferred to the Hawking radiation via a two-step process, one of which involves a certain non-locality, but it's just the non-locality of observables in gravity that we're all familiar with. So that part was the statement that I've argued for this perturbative holography, which says that the... which suggests that the information carried in by the infalling matter is in fact encoded in these asymptotic gravitational fields. But then, if we believe that, from that point, the information can now be transferred to the Hawking radiation by what is essentially a local process, primarily involving the gravitational constraints. It's really just this constraint equation that I've written at the top of the board. Okay. All right, maybe I should... Let me go ahead and just give my quick summary, and then I'll take questions. So, slide 19. Let me just summarize what I think are the important elements of what I said. So, to me, this whole story leads to a kind of new perspective on gravitational information, with the primary results, being this argument for perturbative holography and boundary unitarity, which I claim follow mostly from considerations of the gravitational constraints, gauge invariance, maybe some version of quantum cosmic censorship, and so forth. The physical claim is that information that you normally think of as being localized deep in the interior of a space-time, I claim is also in a certain sense stored in the asymptotic values of local fields, and therefore in the black hole context, you can think of it as being stored sort of throughout the black hole exterior. And as a result of that, information can be locally transferred to Hawking radiation via constraints and energy conservation. Okay. So I should certainly stop now and see if there are questions that I should answer. Thank you.
Okay, we are guaranteed this connection only for 4 more minutes, so please ask questions quickly. We'll just keep going unless somebody interrupts us. It may be that the bridge is reserved for somebody else at 11:30. Questions, comments?
Everyone's leaving.
Yeah. Well, I have lots of questions and comments, but I think Don is going to be here, and so I'll be talking with Don and all of us here will be talking with Don. So if there are no questions from outside, we should just stop right now, just so as to let other people get on the bridge if they need to. Okay, so going once, questions, comments, going twice. Okay, going thrice. Okay. Thanks very much.
Thank you.